I'm Donald MacLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. This is not the rundown tenement in a shabby area of Hamburg where Brahms first saw the light of day, nor the humble country cottage at Broadheath where Elgar was born. In this magnificent pile, a truly stately home named Hynum Court, was born my composer this week, whose very names reek of privilege. If you head out from Gloucester, crossing the Severn and following the A40 for a couple of miles, your sat-nav will direct you to a restricted usage road, which will lead you to the grand estate of Hynum Court. The house, in Jacobean style, began in 1658, just before the restoration of Charles I, is of red brick. Two stories with an attic, the centre five of the nine bays slightly recessed, with white stone ashlar trim around the windows and the corners of the house. In one of the Gloucestershire volumes of his Buildings of England series, the architectural historian Nicholas Pevsner calls Hynum innovatory, and he lingered eloquently over its wall paintings and the splendid stained glass roof of the chapel, which was finished in 1851, 3 years after the birth of one of the people commemorated on a stone monument within it. My composer this week, Sir Charles Hubert Hastings Parry, among whose best-known music is undoubtedly this choral piece for a glorious royal occasion. Hubert Parry's setting of words from Psalm 122, I Was Glad, written for the coronation of King Edward VII in Westminster Abbey in August 1902. Parry's introit had the unique distinction of being sung twice at the service. It was to be performed as the king entered the abbey, but someone gave the signal too soon before the procession was ready to move off, so it had to be sung a second time. Apart from his setting of William Blake's words in the anthem Jerusalem and that introit for the 1902 coronation, a thick layer of dust has settled over almost all of Hubert Parry's music as far as present-day audiences are concerned. But along with George Grove, Parry was a catalyst for a musical renaissance in England during the final decades of the 19th century. Parry had a tremendous influence on music in this country in his lifetime, on the public perception of it, and on its place in public and academic life. As we'll hear, he achieved that in a number of ways, not only as a composer. Parry grew up amid the imposing surroundings of Hynum Court, whose development seems to have been an ongoing project of his father's. Life, one might imagine, would have been really cushy for the young Parry, given the silver spoon he was born with into the landed gentry. His was an untroubled path from landed estate to Eton, then Cambridge and beyond. The institutions of English society were made in his image. Yet the young Parry was a rather lonely boy. He was born in the year of revolutions, 1848, but his mother, weakened by tuberculosis, died within 12 days of his birth, leaving his father, Thomas Gambier Parry, to bring up their three children alone, though not, of course, without extensive domestic help. His father spent much of Hubert's childhood travelling abroad, adding to his collection of objets d'art, while young Hubert was left in the care of a governess. He peopled his solitary childhood at Hynum with imaginary friends. There was bound to be trouble ahead, because rather than entering any of the solid professions that would have been expected of him, Parry wanted to be a composer. So, rather than feeling that the world was his oyster, on leaving Oxford University, where he'd studied history and law with a second-class degree, we find him writing in his diary, "The crash came. The correspondence and loving converse were stopped, and for a short time all was black. Parry's family wouldn't let him pursue a career in music, and Lady Herbert, the mother of Maud Herbert, the girl he'd fallen in love with, wouldn't hear of their engagement. Lady Herbert had plans for her daughter's marriage, and Parry, as mere landed gentry, did not feature in them. She charged Parry, as an honourable man, to release Maud from their tacit engagement, telling him, "It never can be." Well, soon after this, Parry composed a set of 6 short pieces for violin and piano, which he called Songs of Friendship, Freundschaftslieder. Lady Herbert's diatribe to Parry, prohibiting his marriage to her daughter, ended with an ominous phrase suggesting their fundamental incompatibility. "Maud hates music, except for your sake." Parry was determined that money shouldn't be a stumbling block, and when he left Oxford, he gave in to his father's wishes and went to work in the city at Lloyd's Register of Shipping. He didn't make a lot of money, but his self-sacrificial gesture eventually paid off. Lady Herbert relented, and he and Maud were married at St. Paul's, Knightsbridge, in the summer of 1872. "The supreme event of my life," Parry called it. He wrote those pieces we just heard the following year. Lady Herbert's observation about their incompatibility would turn out to be prophetic. From much later, we'll hear Parry's setting of a love sonnet by Keats. "Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art."
Steadfast as thou art, not in long splendor hung aloft a night, and watching with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient sleepless eremite, the moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores. Oh, gazing on the new soft-fallen mask.
Parry would develop a taste for speed. He bought a succession of cars, a Panhard, a Charron, both now extinct French makes, and a Rolls-Royce. And though he could afford to employ a chauffeur, he loved to drive himself, and he did so recklessly. So there were frequent accidents and even write-offs, but he was never seriously injured, though the chauffeur was often sick with fright, and Parry was inevitably one of the first people in the country to get a speeding ticket. He would often drive himself to Hynham whenever he could, but successive visits to his father's house revealed a gradual and steady decline as the upkeep of the place became ever more difficult. Income from rents dried up, and Parry Sr. began shutting up vineries, hothouses, and rooms in the house. After his father and then his stepmother died, the issue arose of what to do with Hynham. His half-brother, Ernest Gambier Parry, had been running the estate, but he was of a very nervous nature and had been stressed out by the strains of audits, investments, maintenance and agricultural prices, not to mention the dire financial straits that the estate was in already. Parry's lawyer didn't think Ernest was up to it. Parry decided to move into the house himself, and this then triggered major ructions in the family. A bitter, unbridgeable rift opened up between Parry and Ernest, as the stack of acrimonious letters that passed between them testifies. In 1873, the year after his marriage, Parry began to have lessons from Edward Dannreuther, who'd studied with the piano virtuoso Ignaz Moscheles in Leipzig. Parry's single-movement Fantasia Sonata from 1878, the year after he gave up working at Lloyd's, shows that Teutonic influence, as well as Parry's admiration for Schumann and Liszt. At Heinem, Parry's father, Thomas Gambier Parry, built a church as a memorial to his late wife and the three of their children who died young. When it was complete, an organ was duly installed and an organist appointed. This was Edward Brind, and he gave lessons to young Parry, not only on the organ, but also in harmony and counterpoint. There was much study of Bach. At Eton, Parry went on to have lessons with the organist at St George's Chapel, Windsor, Sir George Elvie. Parry then began an assiduous study of organs all over the country, in the cathedrals of Gloucester, Hereford, Salisbury, Winchester and Llandaff. He also tried out the instruments in parish churches, including St Mary Redcliffe in Bristol, which he pronounced the most interesting instrument I ever played on. The interest in playing the instrument was first instilled at Heinem at a young age, but it was only from the mid-1870s that Parry began to compose for the organ. We'll hear a chorale prelude, one of a set of seven he published. This one's on the well-known tune Hampton by S.S. Wesley. Parry and his half-brother Ernest were never reconciled about the rift over the fate of Heinem. When Parry died, Ernest couldn't move in quickly enough. His mental state was by this time unstable. He'd blamed Parry for the felling of trees on the estate during the war, and now that he was in the house, suffering a succession of mental breakdowns, he fretted endlessly about the estate. When Parry composed his First Symphony in 1880, a month after he'd heard Brahms's First Symphony, he had only German models in mind. Where was there a British symphony that he could take as any kind of model? Schumann's influence is clear in the music, especially in the first movement, and so is Mendelssohn's, and Beethoven too. But as Bernard Benoliel has pointed out, this second movement, which we're going to hear, is more than the sum of its influences. The cut of phrase and the way the music moves are Parry's own. That distinctive combination of intimate emotion and pastoral evocation, which was to be a hallmark of English music a generation later, makes one of its first appearances in this movement.
Thank you.
As well as having been home to the disgraced former MP Jeremy Thorpe, Orme Square, off the Bayswater Road on the north side of Hyde Park, not far from Queensway Tube Station now, was also the site of Hubert Parry's real musical awakening. Number 12, there's a memorial plaque there now, was where Edward Dannreuther lived, Parry's piano teacher. The two of them had a lot in common. Parry's dad wanted him to go into insurance. He did, for a while. Dannreuther's father, a piano manufacturer in America, wanted him to go into banking. He ran away to Leipzig to study with the pianist Ignaz Moscheles. Parry had enviable contacts, including the piano manufacturer Walter Broadwood, who got in touch with the violin virtuoso Joseph Joachim on his behalf, with the objective, you might as well aim high, of having Brahms take Parry on as a pupil. Despite the prestigious chain of contacts, the answer was an emphatic no. Plan A had failed. Plan B, in November 1873, was to write a letter to Edward Dannreuther. Dannreuther's response was altogether different. His prompt reply came, "Dear Mr. Parry, may I expect you here at 4 o'clock on Tuesday next? I shall be delighted to see you. If I can be any use to you as a pianist, I shall be happy. As a writer, you do not want any help, as far as I can see." 6 years into his lessons with Dannreuther, Parry composed a cello sonata. The first movement came to him quickly and easily, but the slow middle movement was another matter. Even a brisk walk along the sands beyond Preston didn't do any good. Eventually, inspiration did come. It's a highly romantic work with hints of Brahms and Schumann. It wasn't just piano lessons Parry benefited from on his visits to Orme Square. In a way reminiscent of French musical salons, Dannreuther instituted regular gatherings at No. 12, where Parry was able to hear a remarkable variety of chamber music. These soon became the talk of musical London for their progressive programmes, which included works by contemporary composers. Pieces by Brahms, Richard Strauss, Charles Villiers Stanford, as well as some exotica, the Bohemian Polish pianist and composer Franz Xaver Scharwenka, and the Liechtenstein-born composer, not often I have the chance to say that, Joseph Rheinberger. The works by these composers were London's first hearings of such music. As the critic for the Musical Times wrote, "There are probably no concerts given in London at which so many novelties are to be heard as at these performances." For Parry, these concerts were to prove an extraordinary testing ground. It was at one of Dannreuther's privileged evenings that Parry's cello sonata was first performed. Illness is a leitmotif of this entire week. Neither Parry nor his wife Maud was blessed with a robust constitution, and Maud was constantly ill from soon after they were married, ending up an invalid. And though there were periods of recovery and seeming stability, there were also relapses, and Parry would choose to take Maud off to the seaside to enjoy the invigorating air rather than return to polluted London. In Parry's case, the pattern was of total defiance of any medical advice. He had had heart problems in his teens, and this debilitating condition returned in around 1879. The problem, as Parry described it, was extraordinarily irregular action of the heart, which hardly gave me an hour's peace. During the fits, work was impossible, as it was almost unendurable, except by walking rapidly about the room. Parry's excitable, nervous temperament didn't help matters, nor did the periods of isolation he spent at the house he built at Rustington on the coast in West Sussex. Parry himself admitted, "I get so musically depressed in the complete loneliness here, with not a single soul to speak to on a musical subject, that I get almost desperate." At the time of writing that, in 1881, Parry lost heart in the set of songs he'd just finished. He'd abandoned some settings altogether. But his faith in them was restored when he heard them performed by his friend Anna Williams at Orme Square in December of that year.
Take, oh take those lips away, not so sweet he was old. And those eyes, the break of day, lights that to me sleep the more. But my kisses bring again.
Parry's Partita for violin and piano. That's another piece that Parry evidently didn't set much store by. It had its premiere in 1886 at Orme Square, and Parry was apparently surprised by the positive reaction to it. He thought of it as a minor work. When Parry first went to Dannreuther for piano lessons, he was amazed by his progressive approach, as he confided to his diary. He is a decided radical in music and goes for the most advanced style and the most liberal interpretation of the old style. He teaches the piano in a thoroughly radical way and dispenses with all the old dogmas of playing with the intention of obtaining the finest effect by any means. He goes to work thoroughly and has sent me to work on Tausig's hideous mechanical exercises. If they don't drive me mad or kill me, I should think he will do me a wonderful lot of good. Looking at photographs of Parry, every inch the impeccably besuited, bald-pated, handlebar-moustachioed, stereotypical Victorian gentleman, it's difficult to think of him as being quite radical in his own way, but he certainly was. Despite his roots in the landed gentry and the stodgy high Victorian image that's been attached to him, Parry was a philosophical idealist, an atheist, a pacifist. It seems quite fitting that he should have been born in 1848, the year of revolutions. This was the man, after all, who would be knighted for his services to the teaching of music in this country. With his energy and creativity, Parry revolutionised how that was done during the early years of the Royal College of Music. Queen Victoria, who knighted Parry, was a good friend of Mendelssohn and wanted all music to sound like his. Her subjects obliged by writing very proper but not very original music. Parry revitalised English music. His Third Symphony changed the landscape and showed how a composer could create a genuinely English work. The composer Herbert Howells, who fell under his influence, certainly regarded Parry as a near revolutionary. Parry was evidently inspired to compose his string quintet after hearing a performance of the Brahms Quintet by a lineup that included the celebrated violinist Joseph Joachim. After an unsatisfactory first performance of his own quintet at Dannreuther's, Parry tried to interest Joachim in the piece, but without success. He concluded that he had no hope of any help from him, ever. Parry substantially revised the work. Thank you. That commemorative plaque outside No. 12 Orme Square reads, Edward Dannreuther, musician, 1844 to 1905, lived here 1873 to 1894. Host to Richard Wagner for 5 weeks in 1877. Dannreuther was the founder in 1872 of the London Wagner Society. He proposed the idea of a Wagner festival with the aim of helping to mitigate the financial deficit of the opera house Wagner had built at Bayreuth. There were to be 6 concerts, but the cost of putting them on proved to be colossal, and the whole enterprise was a financial disaster. But there was at least the compensation of having the master himself come to London. Parry met Wagner at Orme Square, but for some reason he didn't record his first impression. But the second time they met, he recalled that Wagner was in great fettle and talked to an open-mouthed group in brilliant fashion. He talked so fast, I could catch little of what he said. What delighted Parry most was Wagner's conducting, which he pronounced quite marvellous. He seems to transform all he touches. I was so wild with excitement that I did not recover all afternoon. Not everyone felt so magnetised. Some of the audience walked out of the Rheingold and Walküre concerts. But the extracts from Götterdämmerung went down a storm, and the applause went on for a quarter of an hour. At the time he was working on his second symphony, Parry's musical world was very much dominated by Wagner. He went to Bayreuth to hear the first 3 performances of Parsifal in 1882 and came back with its music still ringing in his ears. That surely accounts for the less distinctively English sound than in his first symphony. I particularly admired the absence of that priggish musicianship that is such a bore in so many new German works. So said George Grove of his friend Hubert Parry's Second Symphony, known as the Cambridge, though his biographer, Jeremy Dibble, says it's certain that something of the composer's immensely happy yet romantically turbulent life at Oxford are contained therein. Musical performances which are unconnected with any religious service and to which admission is given only by purchased tickets should no longer take place. This was the puritanical line taken by Dr. Grantham M. York, the Dean of Worcester, after the cathedral reopened following extensive restoration. The Dean almost put paid to the Three Choirs Festival, the oldest surviving music festival in Europe, which in 1874, when the Dean and Chapter issued that edict, had then been going on for a century and a half. The custom of the cathedral choirs of Gloucester, Hereford and Worcester meeting annually and taking it in turn to play host started in the early 1720s. The issue was taken up in the national and local press. Protests poured in to Worcester Cathedral. A petition was sent to the Queen in Council. The next year's festival was a gloomy, subdued affair with no secular concerts. By the time Worcester's turn came round again in 1878, the Dean and Chapter had capitulated. Thomas Gambier Parry was energetic in his efforts to ensure the festival continued through that tricky time, and the Three Choirs was to prove an important platform for his son Hubert Parry's music, including his oratorio Judith, or The Regeneration of Manasseh. The works rarely performed, but it gave Parry a huge national success at the time, probably not least on account of one great tune. Despite the obscurity of the oratorio, you might recognise the tune as the one which accompanies the hymn, Dear Lord and Father of Mankind. Oh, The original commission for Judith came from the Birmingham Festival. From the very beginning, it was a hard slog for him. Parry was aware that what they would ideally have liked was a traditional Old Testament oratorio. He wrote to his friend and mentor, Edward Dannreuther, that they wanted 2 hours' worth of music for next year's festival. "I think I ought not to let such a chance slip if I can do it, but it's a very short time to find the subject and get into shape and write the stuff. Moreover, I don't like the oratorio notion, though, of course, one can make a work on oratorio lines which shall be perfectly independent of ecclesiastical or so-called religious conventions. Do you think there's anything to be made of the poetical material in the same neighbourhood as Parsifal? Do you think there are any stories of the Albigensians or some such types?" Dannreuther suggested looking at German versions of Sanskrit poetry, Zimrock's mythology, and even the Icelandic sagas. Eventually, Parry settled on the story of the heroism of Judith saving the Israelites by going to the Assyrian camp and, after getting the general Holofernes drunk, cutting off his head. Parry missed out the gruesome beheading in his telling of the story. He got stuck several times, complaining of writing some passages over and over again, working morning, afternoon, after tea and night, and always finding it beastly. The words aren't sufficiently telling. A huge row blew up when the Birmingham committee suggested the finished work was too long and they should only perform the second act. They were eventually talked round into doing the whole thing. In the event, the performance of Judith, conducted by Hans Richter, was a great success and consolidated Parry's reputation nationally. It was taken up by choral societies all over the country. Parry would conduct it himself at the Three Choirs Festival in Gloucester in 1889. Further choral commissions came Parry's way. One of these, which would prove pivotal, was for the Bach Choir. Their first commission, conducted by Charles Villiers Stanford, to perform in a concert that was part of Queen Victoria's Jubilee celebrations in 1887. George Grove suggested to Parry that he should set Milton's Ode at a Solemn Music. His response to the words in this stylish piece, called for 8-part chorus, is clear and powerful. Milton's text is about the marriage of music and verse, the blessed pair of sirens of the title, who symbolise man's desire for union with the heavenly music of the spheres. That music was first performed in 1887, conducted by Charles Villiers Stanford, and it was an instant success. Parry's friend and supporter George Grove, he of the famous Dictionary of Music, had tears in his eyes as he congratulated Parry at the premiere, shaking his hand over and over. Even at the rehearsal, Parry remembered how Grove had jumped up with tears in his eyes and shook me over and over again by the hand, and the whole choir took up the cue. It's ironic that that tune of Parry's from Judith should have become welded to a hymn which became a staple of church worship in this country, since by the time Judith was commissioned in 1887, this man who'd been brought up in a very devout household and married into one which was equally religious had, if not exactly lost his faith, certainly become opposed to organised religion. In 1903, Parry decided to try and express his views in a series of what he called ethical cantatas and oratorios, which he composed over a period of 6 years, though for some of these he did use scriptural texts, as in the one we're going to hear now, The Soul's Ransom, a Psalm of the Poor, which had its premiere at the Three Choirs Festival in Hereford Cathedral in 1906. Parry called this work a Sinfonia Sacra, It's a move away from the pattern of the 19th century oratorio, and it's a kind of summation of his enthusiasms for the music of the 17th, 18th and 19th centuries, which brings voices and instrumental ensembles together. Parry was passionate about Bach, and he was also a great admirer of the music of Heinrich Schütz, who had learned so much about combining vocal and instrumental choirs from his teacher, Giovanni Gabrieli, in Venice. The words in this second section that we're going to hear come from a variety of biblical sources, the Book of Psalms, Isaiah, the Gospels of Matthew and John. For someone brought up in such a conventional Victorian background, Parry had unconventional and rather radical views. He wasn't prepared to swallow the traditional orthodoxies unexamined. He thought of art as a moral ideal in line with the paradigms that the French writer Émile Zola proposed. Zola and his fellows are right after all. Those who make us realise what is hideous and painful and irritating are right. We must look trouble in the face. Art is not solely for consolation. It is not merely for refinement, though that is one of its many benefits. It is not merely for interest, but to make men realise their fellow men's conditions, and to know the many-sided aspects of their sufferings and joys, and to enlarge their sympathies and their understandings. The huge impact of his anthem, Blessed Pair of Sirens, in 1887, and his oratorio Judith's success the following year, prompted a series of new commissions for Parry. When Hans Richter conducted a performance of Parry's Second Symphony, it got a standing ovation, and soon a request came in for a new symphony. When Parry's Third was first performed, with the composer conducting, in May 1889, there was huge excitement amongst music critics, who felt that here, at last, was a genuinely English work. It became known as the English Symphony, though whoever christened it that, it wasn't Parry, and for the next 20 years it was the most often performed symphony by any British composer. Parry himself offered it for performance as short and unimposing. As I said, many of the critics heard the music as being quintessentially English. They saw it as taking its inspiration from the national spirit of English music, whose tunes were vigorous, simple in structure, marked with rhythmic force, moving with solidity, well balanced. By the standards of the time, its Englishness also made it essentially masculine. For the eminent writer Joseph Bennett, for instance, this was something of a hobby horse. He stressed that in this symphony, Parry was in the full vigour of his manhood. And one of the reasons the music was so successful was that it avoided, in Bennett's words, the feminine, mystic and sensational. The Third Symphony is scored for a small orchestra. Walter Alcock isn't a name that gets a high recognition factor in the musical world now, but in his day he was an eminent composer and organist with posts at Westminster Abbey and the Chapels Royal. In the late 1870s, Alcock was one of the first students at the National Training School for Music with Arthur Sullivan and John Stainer. The school was set up to provide free musical education to those who couldn't afford the fees at the Royal Academy of Music. The Prince of Wales and other members of the royal family felt that, despite its good work, the school's status needed to be raised. The man to do that, drumming up the necessary financial support to found the Royal College of Music, was George Grove. Grove was invited to be the first director of the college in 1882. His friend Hubert Parry, who worked with Grove on his dictionary, was in the running for the post of Professor of Musical History at the new institution. But no word came from Grove. Parry's wife Maud, who disliked Grove, was outraged over the slight to her shy, self-doubting husband. "I am cross with Mr. Grove, only I try and realise to myself that, after all, he's a baby and can't help it. He seems to me to be totally devoid of moral courage." This little song was a contribution Parry made to a volume of choral songs in honour of Her Majesty Queen Victoria, an attempt to emulate the triumphs of Oriana, a tribute to Elizabeth I. The offer of the job of Professor of Music History arrived in the post on New Year's Day 1883 from a temporary, though prestigious address, the Duchess of Cornwall office, 1 Buckingham Gate. This was thanks to the generosity of the son of the dedicatee of Who Can Dwell in Greatness, the Prince of Wales, the future Edward VII. Grove apologised for the fact that the rate of remuneration, 15 shillings an hour, was relatively low, but hoped that that would increase when we come to our full strength. The college opened its doors on the 7th of May, 1883. 480 students had been selected to audition from the original 1,500 applicants, and from these, just under 100 students were chosen for the first intake. They included the Irish composer Charles Wood and Hamish McCunn. There were 31 on the teaching staff. As well as lecturing on music history, Parry was expected to help Stanford teach composition. The appointment did a lot to bolster Parry's already solid academic reputation. Parry was a sympathetic teacher who always gave generously of himself to his pupils. The Royal College of Music was to be a central institution in his life. In time, Parry would succeed Grove as director of the college and become an inspiration to the next generation of composers. A few months after his appointment, the University of Cambridge conferred an honorary doctorate on Parry. At the end of the year, there was to be a production of Aristophanes' comedy The Birds, and Parry provided incidental music. Parry's score matches the lightheartedness of the play. One of Parry's missions that he set himself was to do something about the quality of English songwriting at the time. We find him writing this very frank assessment. In this country, songwriting reached in the past generation a pitch of degradation which is probably without parallel in all musical history. Mercantile considerations and the shallowness of average drawing-room taste produced a luxuriant crop of specimens of imbecility, in which sickly sentiment was not less conspicuous than the total ignorance of the most elementary principles of grammar and artistic construction, and of the relation of musical accent to poetical declamation. Parry went on, "If the public can be persuaded not to insist so exclusively upon songs being either vulgar or trivial and vapid, the future of English song will undoubtedly be such as the nation may be proud of." Parry had begun to work on what would prove to be an extended series of volumes of English lyrics. There would be 12 in the end. We get a glimpse of the trouble he went to over getting the declamation exactly right in a letter to his friend and mentor, Edward Dannreuther. There was one song he wanted to include in the first set in 1882, but, as he told Dannreuther, "I've been wrestling with crabbed age and youth, but it seems to be too much for me. The dramatic breaks of continuity at the end jump from one side to the other so abruptly. I've tried it over and over again. If I could get it in order, I should have enough for a set. If not, the set must wait till I can find other words." In the event, Parry couldn't get it to work and substituted another song. He eventually got Crabbed Age and Youth to his satisfaction, and it appeared in the fifth volume 20 years later. Parry's role as director of the Royal College of Music was threatened by his ill health. He'd suffered from heart trouble since his school days, seldom taking much notice of anything his doctors told him. By 1907, the condition was gradually undermining his previously irrepressible sense of joie de vivre. It got so bad that summer that even the prospect of sailing his boat gave him no pleasure. Parry was an enthusiastic sailor and loved the sea. He had bought himself a 21-ton yawl called La Toile. A yawl, in case you're not up on classes of sailing vessel, is a two-masted boat with the second mast well aft of the main one. In a craft of this size, Parry had made adventurous summer trips to the Scilly Isles and to the coast of Ireland. As the heart attacks became more frequent and more severe, his doctors insisted he should resign from his professorship at Oxford University and drastically reduce his composing schedule. The importance of the Royal College of Music to Parry is clear in the fact that he ignored his doctor's advice about abandoning his post there. Parry was deeply distressed about being made to give up his work and consoled himself by taking a Mediterranean cruise with his daughter Dorothea, known as Dolly, and her husband Arthur Ponsonby. Parry's spirits were at a low ebb, but at the age of 60, a creative Indian summer was on the way. Nothing quite captures the spirit of this period of recuperation and recovery as much as his symphonic poem From Death to Life. The second movement is a march back to life. It's called Via Vitae, the Road of Life. symphonic poem From Death to Life by Sir Hubert Parry. He wrote it for the momentously timed 1914 Brighton Festival, where its fate was to have only a single performance. There's no record of any subsequent performance, a fate it shared with Parry's Fourth Symphony, and by the 1960s, all the performing material had disappeared. Parry's Fourth Symphony had its premiere just weeks after his third in July 1889. It was then shelved for more than 20 years and not dusted off again until 1910. Then remained unperformed until the recording we're about to hear from the London Philharmonic, conducted by Matthias Bammert. It was written for the conductor Hans Richter. We'll hear the expansive and fiery first movement. Bernard Benoliel points out that the motif you'll hear at the start is used to change tack like a yachtsman on a rough sea. Bach, Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart, Purcell and Tchaikovsky. They're all that remain. Six stone busts of the composers once stood in niches along the elegant columned curved façade of the Queen's Hall, the concert hall which stood just the other side of All Souls Church in Langham Place from Broadcasting House. You can see the busts now in the entrance hall of the Royal Academy of Music on the Marylebone Road. The Queen's Hall is where the proms began. It was destroyed by an incendiary bomb on the night of the 10th of May, 1941. In Hubert Parry's day, the hall was very much at the centre of London's musical life. Sir Henry Wood several times conducted performances of Parry's music there. On the evening of the 28th of March, 1916, a 300-strong volunteer choir assembled there, eager to sing a new work by Parry under the direction of the conductor Walford Davis. His friend, the poet Robert Bridges, had asked Parry to set the opening verses of a poem by William Blake in support of an organisation called Fight for Right, which had been set up during the war to counteract German propaganda. Bridges urged Parry to set suitable, simple music to Blake's stanzas, music that an audience could take up and join in. Parry was evidently pleased with his setting, but he could have had no idea just how successful it proved to be that night and ever after, or that it would be interpreted in so many ways since.
And it all sit in ancient time, walk upon England's mountains green, and was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen. And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills, and was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mists?
Jerusalem was heard that first time in 1916 in a setting for choir and organ, but it was such a success that Parry was asked to make an orchestral arrangement, which he duly did, and that was used during his lifetime. But Elgar, who much admired the tune, made a more opulent arrangement in 1922, and that's the version which is almost always used, including, of course, at the last night of the proms. Jerusalem's tremendous success really bolstered the cause of Fight for the Right and led to Parry being asked to set other patriotic texts, But the whole business of the blatant, unthinking patriotism and jingoism represented by some of these causes made Parry deeply uncomfortable, another indication of his nonconformity. The following year, he wrote to Sir Francis' young husband, who had founded Fight for Right, and dissociated himself from it, saying that he couldn't any longer support an organisation whose causes he didn't identify with. On the other hand, Parry was entirely happy when the song was taken up by the women's movement in 1917. Parry conducted Jerusalem for the Women of the Albert Hall Choir at a women's demonstration meeting, and when Millicent Fawcett, the campaigner for women's suffrage, suggested that Jerusalem ought to become the women voters' hymn, Parry was delighted. Parry was now moving into what I suppose we have to call an Indian summer, with the harvest of quite a few new works, although there was by now very little interest in what he composed, even in what was one of his greatest choral works, the Ode on the Nativity, set in words by the 16th century Scots poet William Dunbar. That was an unusual choice at the time, when Dunbar's work wasn't really known. Parry's biographer, Jeremy Dibble, regards the work as the composer's masterpiece and marked out the ode as, without doubt, one of Parry's supreme choral achievements. No other of his choral works displays such precision and formal tightness. The ode begins, Rorate Cheli De Super, let the heavens rejoice and let the earth be glad. At the beginning of the autumn term of 1914 at the Royal College of Music, Parry could see that quite a few faces of promising students were missing, notably E.J. Moran, Ivor Gurney, Arthur Benjamin, George Butterworth, George Dyson, Arthur Bliss and Ralph Vaughan Williams. They had all signed up. All too soon, the war made itself felt in many other ways impossible to ignore, like the zeppelins Parry saw above Littlehampton, and the vilification of anything with a German-sounding name. German friends found themselves interned. Parry tried to do what he could, but his efforts to save his personal assistant, George Schlichtenmeier, from being arrested and sent off to a camp, failed. The news from the front of sickeningly barbarous destruction depressed him more and more. Conscription was brought in, leaving virtually no young male students at the college. In 1917, government regulations forced him to fell beloved plantations of trees on the family estate at Hynham. With the cancellation of virtually all the country's major festivals, Parry's participation in concert life dwindled to almost nothing, though that did leave him time to compose. During these desperately bleak years, Parry was working on a set of unaccompanied motets, his Songs of Farewell. During their composition, he sometimes endured 3 heart attacks a day. At Parry's own funeral in St. Paul's Cathedral, the song struck a noble and elegiac tone. Parry called the songs motets, but these aren't conventionally devotional works, but highly personal expressions of Parry's contemplation of his end, the testimony of a man troubled and uncertain of the future, saddened by the carnage and the suffering of war.
Thank you.
The calamity of the First World War was mirrored in Parry's own failing health, which, towards the end of 1917, deteriorated significantly, so that people who knew him were only too aware that this once ebullient man was now weary, often silent, and deeply troubled as he saw the war about to enter another year. Life at home was very grim indeed. His wife Maud was now being prescribed barbiturates, then in their relative infancy, as a drug. The medication had a dramatic effect, producing extreme highs and lows, and making the already very difficult Maud absolutely intolerable to live with. Parry's son-in-law, Arthur Ponsonby, gave a vivid impression of what life was like for Parry with Maud. His wife never cared for his music and never shared his life, was no companion, and with her funny arrested development and self-centred smallness of vision, was no help or comfort to him at all. His devotion to her was pathetic. She hampered him, irritated him, bullied him, was a drain on him. This gave him the melancholy note which came out in his music. We've been hearing from Parry's symphonies throughout the week, and today we've reached the fifth and last of them. This was to be Parry's most mature work as a composer for orchestra. He gave the four movements titles which suggest a strong element of autobiography. Stress, he knew plenty about that. Love, play, and now! We'll hear the second slow movement, Love, the most glowing music of the symphony, underpinned by the idea that we must look to human love as our hope of salvation and healing. The 27th of February 1918 marked Parry's 70th birthday. His room at the Royal College of Music filled up with flowers, and there were accolades in the newspapers. A few days later, Adrian Bolt conducted a performance of Parry's Symphonic Variations. The composer had reservations about Bolt's interpretative powers, but he was evidently pleased by what he heard. He wrote to Bolt the following day, "I am much beholden to you for a surprisingly good performance of those ancient variations." That would be the last public performance Parry would hear of his own music. He wouldn't live to see the armistice. He died just a month before it was signed. There's a certain irony for a man who must have assumed that he would die as a result of heart problems that had plagued him all his life, that he actually died of blood poisoning. When I first joined the BBC a very long time ago, there was still a visible remnant of the Queen's Hall. Walking a little way down Great Portland Street, there's a curious little gap between two buildings. There's a stretch of wall between them with a band of stone about 2 metres up. Then you could read, quite clearly, painted on the stone, Queen's Hall. Several decades of rain and polluted London air have totally effaced the name, leaving not a trace behind. I don't suppose there are that many people still around who even remember that that last vestige of the great concert hall was ever there. How many times in that hall, and then in the venue which succeeded it as the home of the Proms, has the roof been raised by massed voices singing Parry's much-loved anthem, the song which has eclipsed everything else he wrote in the mind of the general public? That will never be effaced.
Thank you. both just butting in at the end of your podcast. I'm Eleanor Rosamond Barraclough, earwigger on the past, snapper-up of unconsidered historical trifles, gatherer of the weird, wild and wacky. I'm here to tell you about Time Travellers, a brand new podcast that's packed full of quirky stories from the corners of history. If you'd like to know how a polar bear ended up catching its dinner in the Thames, why Poldark was much loved in post-fascist Spain, what happens if you give a spider too much caffeine, how the suffragettes weaponised roller skating, and what any of this has to do with anything, then you'll have to subscribe to Time Travellers, wherever you normally find your podcasts.